Hello again, and welcome to the Orient Hour on Phoenix 98 FM. This is Steve Tung, and in today's programme, socially distanced as ever, we have Trevor Singfield. How are you, Trevor?
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Steve. Very good.
Good to hear. And Lee Boyce, up all night, but in good form?
Yeah. Evening. How are you doing?
Well done. Lee and Trevor, the sort of people who'd normally have been shooting off to Carlisle on a Tuesday night. Our special guest in this programme, who we hope will be joining us later, would find that more difficult because Neil Kaufman, the club's official historian for many years, is in Johannesburg, South Africa, where they tend to get power cuts all the time, rather unexpectedly. We do hope he'll be able to join us a little later in the programme. Now, some might say Neil did well to miss Saturday's game against Colchester. He had a power cut then and wasn't able to follow the stream. But what about the O's otherwise? The mood, I suspect, a bit frustrated, and the club certainly upset, I think, about having the expense then of having the Carlisle game called off less than 3 hours before kickoff. So we'll talk about that and try and see what the mood is out there. And big news on the financial front too, the Players' Union, the PFA, have won their fight against the salary caps that were due to be introduced next season and which the Orient board were very much in favour of. So good news perhaps for all our players who were out of contract, but will the board be prepared to bite the bullet, maybe accept even bigger losses and keep them on slightly higher wages? And we'll also have details later of the Orient Hour's own tribute to the hugely popular Simon Fellman, the man on the door, and so much more, who very sadly passed away last week. It was good to hear the minutes of applause for him at the Colchester game. But what about that match? On its own, I suppose, not the worst result in the world, but a fourth successive game without a goal, which makes, what, 2 points out of 12 now, just after we'd crept up into the playoff places. Trevor, what did we think?
Yes, it was a poor game overall. I agree with that. I think there was quite a lot of expectation after 10-minute Crawley. Nearly got a good result there. A lot of people say it was a good result, getting a point at Crawley. I don't think we've ever got anything there. I thought Colchester were poor and they were obviously on a poor run of results, and I don't think they really came for a game of football with us. They had a small, brief spell where they went long, fed off the scraps. They managed to hit the post and Basel. It was hard to say which bit they hit. And that was the only time I think Lawrence was really troubled. I think they were more hell-bent on actually stopping the Orient from playing. And we create a few clear-cut chances, and their goalkeeper was equal to it. But overall, there was enough pace and purpose about the Orient going forward. But yeah, won't live long in the memory, will it?
Right. Well, I believe we are being joined by Neil Kaufman in South Africa. Neil, we can hear you and we can even see you. Those of us on the Zoom
call,
this won't be able to. Tell us how you are in Johannesburg.
Yeah, all good, all good. Unfortunately, we in South Africa are battling with the COVID like everyone else we know. We follow all the news in the UK. Unfortunately, our variant, the South African variant, I'm sure you've heard of it, it's not accepting the AstraZeneca vaccine. So we're battling a bit here. But I'm good. I'm good. So great to be in regards from Joburg.
And are you managing to keep up with the Orient, apart from, I believe, Saturday's game? Was that a power cut game?
Yeah, no. Well, Saturday, I did see the end of the game. I had to actually go out. It wasn't power. We do have load shedding here, which is power cuts. No money in the country, I'm afraid. But no, to answer your question, yeah, I follow the O's. I'm on email to so many people, you can't believe. Yeah, and follow the websites, the club. I'm in touch with the club on a weekly basis. So in touch with Nigel in the States. So it's good. By the way, I also want to send a former player, Ron Willis, is in South Africa. He lives in Durban, and we're in touch all the time. And he sends regards to everyone at the Orient.
Ron Willis, that's great to hear. We're relying on you for some historical perspective today. Just looking at this season. I was going to say that even by the O's standards, this season has just been so up and down, hasn't it? Runs of wins, runs of defeats and so on.
It's unbelievable. It's inconsistent, but I look at it this way. Look, I'm just happy the club are back in the EFL. It didn't look like it was going to get there when what was happening with the Italian mob. So very appreciated that with Nigel and Kent, we're back in the league. But I think, look, yes, we have been inconsistent. But I think we've got a very strong defence, a good goalkeeper, 11 clean sheets, I believe, so excellent. The only thing I'm a bit worried about is Vig's distribution, kicking distribution. They seem to end up in touch or to an opposition player. Other than that, very strong defence. Midfield, look, I think Nick Freeman's going to be a very good acquisition. I know of him. I know from his previous clubs that he's a very go-forward player. Likes attacking, good dribbler. And I think, unbelievably, with Jabu there, excellent. 39 years of age is unbelievable. And, you know, I just want to tell you that he, in his career, has played over 740 games. It's unbelievable. For a fee of, total fee of 1.7 million in this day and age, 78 goals. He's unbelievable. I think he's and we've got guys who could score goals. DJ is excellent in the box. I think maybe this Mesut Carlisle may do him good an extra few days. And we've got the other, Wilkinson can score goals. And I think the new guy, you know, we've got to give him a chance. I've also got friends at West Ham and they say he's an excellent prospect. And we'll just give him a bit of time. Andy Thompson is very strong in defence. So I think, you know, I'm looking forward to getting into the playoffs. I can't see why we can't do it. As you said at the beginning, to be consistent, that's the thing. If we could pick up a few wins from the draws, we'd be well. So I'm happy.
Good. You're happy. Well, we'll come back to you shortly. Let me turn to Lee. What did you make of Colchester and or Crawley, Lee?
Yeah, Colchester, very disappointing. Saying it, disappointing going forward, but when you try to build the team, you've got to build it from the back, haven't you? So two clean sheets on the back, you've got to take the positives out of that. But, we do need to start creating chances again. Hopefully, you know, DJ's back. It will happen.
A lot of talk, as usual, about the formation, people wanting a change away from 4-3-3. But knowing Ross as we do, it's not going to happen, is it?
Not with the players we've got, no, because we've got no out-and-out wide players. People saying about Brophy going on the left. What I don't understand is why no one calls for Joby to go on the left. And I thought Joby's much more got more assists in him than Brophy has. But no, with the way the formation, the way the players we've got at the moment, we'll stick with that 4-3-3 or 4-1-4-1, as some people are saying it is.
That does seem likely. Well, let's get one more view or two more views of the Colchester game from two people who were actually at the game, Dave Victor and Matt Hiscock.
Another game for Carlisle United to try and fit in, and another goalless draw for the O's.
Yeah, it was. Again, you always look at the positives, Dave. It's another clean sheet. But I think ultimately, overall, there'll be disappointment that the O's weren't able to secure 3 points this afternoon, particularly with Colchester's run coming into the game, 9 games without a win. So disappointing from that aspect, but again, always try and find the positives and a clean sheet has to be one of them.
It's now four games without a goal, and it's not a coincidence that it's coincided with the fact that Dan Johnson hasn't been able to start.
Yeah, no doubt about it, is there? I mean, when you look at Orient in terms of creativity, Connor Wilkinson always looks the most likely in terms of creating and unlocking the door. But unfortunately, without Danny Johnson, they just haven't really been able to test the opposition goalkeeper in recent weeks. And that has been a common theme.
Tristan Abrahams did start, though.
He did. Yeah, he didn't see too much opportunity come his way, did he, throughout the 90 minutes. And it was interesting when Ross Embleton did make the substitution. He moved Tristan Abrahams out onto the left-hand side. It's 90 minutes for him, a player who probably just needs a little bit more in terms of fitness and sharpness. Good to see him back. He will be influential between now and the end of the season.
Now, you spoke to Steve Ball and Colchester felt they had a goal.
It was interesting. He's looked at it and his appraisal was that the goal should have stood. Frank Nuble's header, which hit the woodwork. He looked at it on the monitor, as did his coaching team after the game and at half time, and they felt Colchester should have been given that goal. They felt the ball clearly crossed the line. I think it was difficult from where we were, but he was disappointed, the Colchester manager.
Yeah, his best chances probably failed to have Connor Wilkinson.
They did. He just makes things happen, doesn't he? He tries to unlock the door. He's a dangerous player. I think a lot of teams have a lot of respect for Connor Wilkinson, and that's why they always try and double up on him. But he continues to cut inside, cause problems, create. For me, he was the most likely in unlocking the door this afternoon, but he just didn't have it.
Adam Thompson again, outstanding.
Yeah, I was really impressed with Adam Thompson. I think, again, you look at the game in its entirety, he made a couple of errors just towards the end of the game, but it's very difficult because you look at the lack of football he's played in the last 12 months. So it's 2 games in a week for him. He played at Crawley on Tuesday, he played again this afternoon. But I thought overall he was very pleasant, and in terms of the way he tried to bring the ball forward, thought he was positive, and yeah, like the look of him.
A red card for Hector Cipriano, of course, and that meant another start for Usise. He's not the same, though, is he?
Well, it's interesting that the role he plays in the team. I think when you're at home, he can be pinpointed at times as perhaps not showing that positive momentum. He's a player who plays a holding role. When you're at home against the likes of Colchester, a team who have been on the back foot in recent weeks, I think you just want that little bit more positivity. You could argue his teammates, did they show enough creativity themselves? But I think for Usise, he'll probably look back on that. It wasn't his best 90 minutes.
And there were a couple of chance occasions when it looked that he and Thompson were doing the same thing, really. Do you need Cisse in that holding role when you've got a defender as good as Adam Thompson?
Well, this is the argument, isn't it? Is it a case of do you retain the formation as it is? Ross Embleton has stuck by the 4-3-3. I should imagine he will continue to do that, because it's a system he believes in and it's one where he's got the players drilled. But there is an argument, do you look at 4-4-2 as a potential plan B? In which case, yes, in that scenario, I think you could vacate Usise in the middle with either McEnough, Clay, or of course Freeman.
Injuries for Clay and Samling as we look ahead to Saturday in Harrogate.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one, isn't it, as we stand here after the game against Colchester. Harrogate have beaten Crawley on the road, a 3-1 victory, an impressive victory for them. And again, another long distance for the O's. We'll go there with confidence. It's a place where we've achieved victories in the past in the National League, but it'll be a tough game.
Another defeat for Crawley, not playing well. You know, there was that fuss that Jon Jens made when we had that goalish tour in West Sussex, and he was blaming the referee, calling him a clown. I think it was all nonsense. I think he was distracting from the fact that his team played against 10 men for the majority of the game. They didn't get a shot on target, including a penalty. Thanks, Matt.
That's Matt Hiscock and Dave Victor, our usual commentary team at the game. So happy enough with a clean sheet. Would like a bit more positivity from Cisse in particular. And a claim from Colchester, which we hadn't heard before, that Nublé header might have been over the line. Anyway, Dave also mentioning there Jon Jems, the Crawley manager, who had described the referee of our previous game as a clown. And you probably heard has now been charged with attempting to enter the referee's dressing room. Probably just as well it was only attempting to enter and that he didn't actually succeed in the mood he was in. So, Trevor, two goalless games prompted very different moods, I think, because Crawley with 10 men felt like a point gained. Colchester really felt like points dropped. And social media, there was quite a lot of anger, wasn't there? Was that justified in any way, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of anger on social media all the time nowadays. I think I read a tweet from Bill Linnell and he said, I think it's mainly born out of frustration that we can't go to our various places after the game to get it off your chest face to face. So, like, you know, you go to supporters, club, coaching horses, or even for a bite to eat and yeah, 20 minutes chat and then you're on to something else. But you're sitting in your house after watching the stream, and when it's as bad as the Colchester one, because it wasn't a spectacle at all, you understand the fans' frustration gets born quite quickly. But, you know, the way I look at it, I generally don't go on it after the game, may have a little look in. It's a very small minority on Twitter. And basically, if you don't like it, don't follow them and get on with it. But overall, yeah, it was a frustrating afternoon. And we are expecting more from the team, especially with the new players coming in. But you've got to give these guys a bit of time to bed in.
Lee, is that the key with the new players? I know you've admired Dan Kemp, I think, the West Ham lad, for quite a long time. But are he and Freeman and maybe less so Thompson at the back going to need that time?
I don't think they'll need the time. It's just they're all fitting together. I mean, the last few weeks, like we've had Happy and now Hector, both suspended, you've Johnson injured. We need everyone to be fit, to be playing in the right positions for it to work. I say hopefully that'll be next few weeks. But yeah, like I said, I mean, I like Kemp. I think I think all the players have added something already that have come in.
I don't know if you heard Kemp Teague on an Orient podcast at the weekend. Very interesting. He emphasised how the board do monitor social media. They seem, I suspect, to take quite a lot of notice of it anyway. And he mentioned a desire by Orient fans to wanting to be top of the league and winning every game 3-0. And he thinks that's quite a good thing. But Neil, on a historical note, I wonder if some Orient supporters have expectations which can't be justified, really. I mean, most of us on here when we started were a second division club, but we haven't played at that level for what, 40-odd years, 1982. Do you think, what is our real place in the scheme of things, do you think, as a club? What would you say, Neil?
Scheme of things as a club. Look, I think Nigel's mentioned and Kent had stepped, giving a few years to get back up the league. When I left for South Africa in 1981, I think the following season they were relegated. Maybe I should have stayed. But, you know, they had a decent squad in those days. But then once everything happened, they went down. But I think the policy is to get Orient up the league. And I think it's going to take a bit of time. You know, if we can have a good season this year and get into playoffs and things go well for us. I know playoffs are not the greatest for the O's, but if we can do well in that and get up, I think we'll see some new players. The cap is, salary cap has now been chucked out. So hopefully we can keep some of our better players, especially DJ, because I think if you've got a goal scorer in there, you can go anywhere. And he gets the right, you know, midfield help. So, yeah, I think the future looks bright. But if we can, you know, maintain that, keep our better players and bring some new faces in the summer, I think we're in for a good time. But long, as you said, right at the beginning, consistency. We can't go three wins, three losses, three wins, three. You've got to be consistent to have a decent team and a decent place up the league. So I'm hopeful we can get back up that league. And get back where we were in the 80s, you know, which was many, many years in the old Division 2, and we performed well. And it was wonderful to go and see those teams, you know. You used to go away, go and see the big teams. Hopefully we can get there again. And I think, look, people just have to be, as someone mentioned now, you have to be patient with the new players. It's going to take time. But they're looking good, and I think we've got a strong squad. Someone mentioned Cissé about his performances. I must say, I did watch last season. He looked good. This season, I don't know what's happened. Pace-wise, you know, he seems to have lost it. But please, he can get that back. Give him a rest and get it back. So, I'm confident.
That's quite a common view. Trevor, the Championship looks to me a little bit different these days, more powerful, more money than in our old Division 2 days. Could we realistically be a Championship club these days, do you think?
To answer that question, obviously what Neil says, historically we've been a sort of third and fourth division team. The facts tell you that we've only spent 20 years odd in the top divisions. To get to the Championship is obviously the owner's end dream. I think it is a bit of a dream because we got close in 2014. We'd all like as fans to go up there because there's a few grounds we'd all like to go and visit we haven't seen for 20, 30 years. Let's get the League One first. I mean, one thing I noticed Kent did say, which I thought was quite damning, maybe in a way, maybe I took it the wrong way, that he said most of that squad was Justin's squad and Martin's working on getting four players in each window. So, excuse me, it's going to take three or four windows to release the players that took us out in the National League. And I thought that was quite an interesting statement that Kent put out there. So slowly, slowly, we're going to build a side that's going to be League One ready to make the final push. And then there's no reason why we can't establish ourselves for like the 10 or 12 years we were in League One and then cultivating in a couple of good seasons. But they don't come around very often, good seasons. Sort of every 7-9 years, you get a good season out of Leighton Orient. And the history book tells you that, I think.
Yeah, well, going back to the present, the mood was quite bad after Colchester, as we've said. I was a bit concerned about the effect that a bad result at Carlisle would have had, because they've been going well. In fact, on sort of points per game, they're actually the top of the table, but they've got so many games in hand. Lee, what about the actual postponement? Our players had actually left Leighton at lunchtime the day before for an overnight stay. We knew all about the weather forecast. It didn't look very good, did it, on Carlisle's point?
No, it's terrible. Terrible on Carlisle's point. I mean, I can understand them wanting an earlier kick-off, and I agree with that, like to try and get it on. But I think we was on our way, or players were on their way up there when the announcement was made it was going to be an 2:30 kick-off. So they knew then that it was in a bad way. It's just, I don't know, just can't believe that they've left it that late, really, and let us travel all the way up there, stay up overnight, and then call it off 3 hours before. If it was a Saturday afternoon, the decision would have been made on a Friday before the team left for that sort of journey. So I don't understand why they've let us travel up there.
No, they were obviously desperate to get the game on. They've still only played 23 games to our 27. So four games in hand on the leaders they've got, and they're only 6 points behind them. But they've now got about 23 more games to fit in over 11 or 12 weeks. So no surprise they wanted to play, but very frustrating and very costly, as you say. I think when we went up to Barrow, similarly, they told us it was going to cost £7,000 with all the cost to us. And I understand the club will be trying to get some of the expenses back from either Carlisle or the EFL or both. But you wonder how much success they'll have with that. At the moment, it's just more money out of the club's pockets. Well, let's look at a few individual performances. As Dave and Matt said, we missed DJ. Of course, we did. Has anyone, Trevor, anyone who's been standing in for him impressed at all? There was Lee Angle first, there was Ruel who played at Bolton, and then we've seen Tristan Abrahams, who's been given a game up the middle as well. They all had a go. We won't count Josh Coulson for his 5 minutes up the front, but what about those three? Has anybody of those impressed?
Well, the most impressive one for me is Lee Angle, but none of them have filled the DJ's boots, let's just say, with in return of goals. It's a difficult position for a striker to play for the Orient at the moment. And I think DJ said after Salford, he had 9 touches, but he got the winning goal. And that's what he's paid to do. So he's got big boots to fill at the moment. So Tristan Abrahams, once he gets up to proper speed, he's going to be capable. And it just depends on the service he gets in. I like to see the ball come in the box a bit more now. We've got Tristan in there because he's a big fella and put himself around a bit. So I hope Kent gets the ball in the box a bit quicker and the fullbacks. If you don't put it in, you don't score a goal. But it's big boots to fill. And, yeah, I think we're struggling there to accommodate a player to come in and field them.
And Adam Thompson at the back, did you like him?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I can watch him. He's a bit like Nathan Clarke with more pace. And I liked him a lot. He looks a really good acquisition. If we sign him, I'll be more than happy.
And Lee, the other two new boys, Kemp and Freeman, what positions do you see them filling exactly? And are they in the right place at the moment? Kemp wide on the left and Freeman just behind?
I think in the formation we're playing, probably Kemp's in the right position. I mean, like you see with Kemp, he's not the biggest, not the quickest over the ground. It's what he does with the ball and finds the space. So he needs to be in a role where he's not being marked so tightly, where he can find that space. So I think, yeah, that's probably the best role for him now. Freeman's just I know they've said he can play on the wing, but I think he'd lose so much if you took him out the middle. He's just like an all-action midfielder, and he's don't stop running. Ball sticks to his feet when he's running. He opens up play. He's ideal. I mean, like I said before, all four signings have been fantastic, really.
Are we boring? I don't know if you saw the person who said Saturday at 3 o'clock, he puts paint on the wall and watches it dry because it's about as much fun as watching the game and it's cheaper, which is possibly a bit unfair. But our patient style, very much the modern way, isn't it? But it does upset some people the way we just move the ball around, especially at the back.
I think that's sort of the way a lot of teams set up now, isn't it? England do it, the same sort of thing. It's very, very slow. It's I don't know, because like I said, when they count the stats and all that, and it's the passing that they count. And you think, well, hold on, you've just moved it around the back line like 6-7 times. But yeah, it's a very boring, or very slow, I wouldn't say boring, very slow build up, this formation. But I said, that's the way, if you sort of end up with the end result, then everyone's laughing, aren't they? Everyone's happy. But we're just, we need to get that ball in the box a bit more. Bit more often, really.
Yeah, it's all about results, isn't it, in the end? Well, we'll come back to the present and the future with the trip to Harrogate on Saturday, and we'll talk a bit more about the proposed salary cap. But let's turn back to Neil, who retires at the end of this season as official club historian. After how long, Neil, when did you start following Orient just as a fan?
I can tell you about I remember very clearly now, funny enough, my first match that I went to. But it was my dad. He supported the O's back in the 1920s. He used to live in Clapton, so obviously the local club. And he used to tell me about some of the matches he went to. He went to the Newcastle United, a big famous FA Cup victory in the 20s. Told me about the goalkeeper, Arthur Wood, in the history books, is a famous player, goalkeeper. It was in 1957. We lived in Hoxton. I'm sure you know the area. My dad was a tailor, and he worked in Shoreditch. So if you can think of Shoreditch, you would then think of Harry Zussman, because his factory was in Shoreditch, and my father, being a tailor, used to make suits for him and talk to him often about the Orient. And then he started talking about, I've got my son, he wants to go and watch. So he gave my dad three passes, one for my brother, my dad and me. And we went, it was Christmas Day, 1957, we watched Orient play Rotherham United, and we won 6-2. And of course, the player to watch in those days was Tommy Johnston, because he was unbelievable. And he really impressed. As a young boy, I mean, his heading was unbelievable. Four goals that day. But my real favourite player was Phil Woosnam, because he just had some skill, some real magic. So those were my favourite players. That was my first match. It was I remember the day. It was like a misty day. We had a lot of fog in those days. I don't know why. So I was put. The passes were by the dugouts. Don't you remember the old ground, the dugouts, and the old main stand? And I actually sat on the home dugout on top of it to watch the game. And at the end of the game, manager at that time was Les Gore. And he came over, shook my hand, and he says, I'm sure that's made your Christmas, because he said to me, it certainly made mine. And yeah, it did. It was a great game. And from there, that's how it all started. That was the seed. So thanks to my dad and obviously to Harry Zussman, because my dad had a great friendship with him. He was a lovely man, you know, and Orient was his life. Harry Zussman, Orient was his life. He put so much money into it. Got the famous Bernard Delphont and the Gray brothers into the club. So, yeah, so that was my first game.
And how did you start the actual researching? Were you keen on keeping records and statistics from early days?
Even as a young boy, what I used to do is I used to go to the library in Shoreditch there in Kingsland Road. I don't know if you will know the areas. And I used to go to the Hackney Gazette, which was also just opposite Hoxton in Kingsland Road. I used to get all the newspapers and make notes on the players. As I was getting a bit older, make notes on the players' transfers, where they went to, where they came from, all things, ages, their heights, their weights, and that's how it all started. I started my work at a Jewish Chronicle newspaper, and every Saturday, as I was getting a bit older, I used to go to the British Library in Colindale in those days. So I used to get the buses to the West End, get a bus to Wood Green, and get the tube or the train to Colindale and do research. And what I found, I don't know if people are aware, that at the Colindale Library, I think now it's in the city somewhere, I'm not sure where they moved to, but they still have, bound volumes of every Clapton Orient program from 1908 to 1939. It was amazing. To me, that was the research that really got me going, you know, to find players like Richard McFadden. And no one knew about these guys. No one ever knew about these players until Alan Ravenhill, which you may know of, was my cohort in writing for the Orient. We used to go every Saturday morning before matches. We used to go for a few hours to the library, get out two, three program annual, the seasonal programs in bound volumes, and make notes of everything that we could find. So, yeah, that was amazing for me to find all those programs and to find out how the club started, Homerton College, the cricket team, the dates, the actual date the club were founded, which was just out of interest, Sunday the 18th of May, 1881, and to come across all these wonderful players to find out about Orient in World War One. Yeah.
So, Neil, what actually started in 1881 was a cricket club. What are the earliest football matches that anyone's been able to discover?
It was about about 1888-ish, round about there, they started. What happened was that the club actually started as Glen Cricket Club because they played on the Glen Park in Clapton. And then eventually, as I say, it was the Homerton College, which was a college for the Puritans. I know Steve Jenkins does a lot of work on with them, so they're well known to us about the way they started. And then football started. They started as an amateur club. And then eventually they changed their name to Clapton Orient because they were obviously in Clapton. And it was a link with the P&O, the old P&O, the Oriental Shipping Lines, later become the Peninsula Oriental Steamship Company. And that's how the Orient name came to being. Eventually they moved into the amateur leagues, and then 1904 they moved into they turned pro, and in 1903 and played in the Southern League for one season. Then didn't do too so great, but then because of the league wanted another London Southern club, and it was Orient and Chelsea in 1905 who joined the league at the same time, the Football League. So two clubs, and Orient being the oldest, second oldest professional league club, Fulham being the first. I think they started
So Orient against Chelsea that year was actually the first ever London derby in the league, because Woolwich Arsenal, of course, the only other team in the top division.
Yeah, so it was Chelsea, and it had some big crowds there. You know, they used to get the big crowds. Look, we never had a great season. The first season, we finished bottom. So, but then a guy, because they went into liquidation, actually, but then had to refund. And it was a guy called Captain Henry Wills Holland who became chairman of the club, and they went forward from there. Appointed Billy Holmes, a Manchester City player, as manager, player manager, and he stayed there 22 years as manager till he passed on. He's died in the street, died in the old German hospital after he collapsed in the street. So yeah, so that's the early days, you know, but. It was interesting, as I was saying before, interesting to research these things, you know, that's because no one at the club knew, really. There was talk about no one knew when the club started, who were the early players, nothing. So this is why it was wonderful that Alan Ravenhill and myself could do this. And that's how it started. You know, we did our first book in 1974. We were given a deadline of 2 months to put it out because Brian Winston wanted it out quickly. But it was great. Great to find all this stuff, and that now we know the true history of the club.
Neil, when I've read all your books and that, is there any sort of physical evidence of the original findings of the Orient back in the 1880s? Because it does seem sort of up in the air. And did you find that frustrating that you couldn't physically any physical papers that would have been?
We weren't sure when we first started to do this research about the club. We, you know, there's talk about 1880, 1881, 1888. It was all different years, and there wasn't much proof until we started the research at the Colindale Library. We went to the club programs, as I mentioned, which is wonderful research. But it wasn't really that. It was the local newspapers. Because there was a newspaper called the Hackney Spectator, but it's not going anymore, and the Hackney Gazette, obviously, still going. So those were the two main research sources that we looked at. We did research at the Colindale Library, and we did research at the local libraries in Hackney and Shoreditch, who followed this. And there were articles interviewing with former players of those early days, how they started, and that's how we got the date. And then we found they talked about the end. There was a one of the early annual meetings. They talked about the formation and the date, which was, as I mentioned, May 1881. So, it was good. We can actually get to the truth because there were so many stories no one really knew, you know. So it was nice that we could do that. And we could put it in a written format so it's there for posterity, you know, that people know. And even now put onto our badge many years ago by Brian Winston when it was all designed and by the two guys who designed it, and he changed it, the current club bench. So, yeah, so it was good. It wasn't going to go on, in fact. I said to Brian about the club badge. It wasn't going to be put on, the date. And I said, well, put the date on, you know. It's 1881. Let's put it on so everybody knows. So that's how it actually got onto the badge, the club badge.
That's excellent. As you speak about the research at Colindale, that's actually moved up north now, that that research place, because they didn't have enough room in the London Library.
No, they never. Yeah. And you know what? We actually said to them, is there any way we can buy those programs? They were in bound volumes, you know. It's, each season is a bound volume. And what happened was that the club used to send the library a copy every week of the home programs, first team and reserve. Got them all there. So, yeah, so they said, no ways, even if it's the club who came to us, there's no ways you're going to buy them. This is here for prosperity. And they're in good condition, eh? I mean, we started in the probably the late 60s when we first started to go, and they're like brand new. We were the first people, they said we were the very first people to actually use them as a research tool. No one's ever used them before. They were there, but no one's ever used them. So, and we came across it by chance, because we thought, you know, the name, asked them, they said they did keep football programs. So they said, they looked up Clapton Orient, they looked up this. Eventually they found Oriental Notes, and that's what it was called. And that's how it's indexed, it's Oriental Notes. So eventually we got it, and we were there every week. And when we had holidays, we would go to those holidays. So yeah, we spent years there, years.
Yeah, it's an absolute privilege to actually physically see them, because I'm a bit of a collector of the Clapton Orient stuff myself. And yeah, they wouldn't sell them anyway, because I did see a bound volume go at an auction house, and it was four figures, nearer £6,000-£7,000. So,
I know.
Wow.
We didn't say by chance. We thought if we say we're working with the club, they might give it to us. I used to collect. Sorry, someone asked about how do I start. I also collected programs. And when I came to South Africa, I had at least 5,000 audio programs, all bound volume. I bound them myself. I had a company do it for me. So when I went to South Africa, there's no way I could have taken them. You know, it's just too heavy. So Brian Winston said, look, what I'll do is, you've given so much to the club, I'll give you an offer. And he booked them from me, the bound volumes. So, because he said he wanted to set up a sort of a museum orient thing. I don't think they ever got off the ground. But funny enough, my brother, just to go quickly, my brother had a call from the club when Barry Hearn was redeveloping the ground, all the new stands. And they had my details in the programs. I used to put my number and address. And they said to my brother, look, we're knocking down the stand. And there's a storeroom under one of the old stands that we're going to be knocking down or redeveloping. And all these books are in there with Neil's name in. And they were the programs. They were kept in the storeroom at the ground. They were going to throw them all away because they were going to go in a dump. So I said, look, even if they go in the dump, we can come and collect them, and maybe get them back to Neil or whatever. So that's how they are. Now they're in the hands of Davis Watson, who's the club's co-deputy historian, who's taken over from me, and he's got them there for prosperity. Because originally, I took them, when I went for my brother's funeral in 2015, I took the programs, and he had them there in the flat. I took them and gave them to Steve Jenkins to keep, and eventually Steve's now given over to Davis, who will look after them. So, yeah, they're all there. But wonderful, as you say, it was wonderful to find that history, because as I mentioned before we left, players people didn't even know of. I mean, Richard McFadden was one of the great Orient players of pre-war, and the point he did in, you know, World War One, and the whole people, saving all these people's lives and things from the fires and all this. No one even heard of this guy, you know, and all these players, Parker, George Scott, you know, these names are now in the Orient's history for what they did and passing on in World War One, all this sort of stuff. But no one ever heard of any of them. Arthur Wood, I mean, no one heard of this guy. I mean, it's unbelievable when you now look at the history of the club and you see where the part that they played, Just imagine Arthur Wood. I mean, he was like 22 stone. 22 stone. I mean, this is after he retired, but when he joined Oil, it was about 15 stone. What happened was, when Oil had lost 8-0 to Aston Villa in the FA Cup, 0-8, I should say, was home. We lost after drawing near 0-0. He let in 8 goals. And as he walked off the pitch, he's just crying. He couldn't, you know, he just didn't want to meet his colleagues. He didn't want to go into the dressing room. And as he was walking off, he sat on the ground crying, and he walked off crying, pouring tears. He got a standing ovation from 23,000 people as he walked off. And now the reason I know that is that there was a player called Eddie Lawrence, who was a Welsh international with Orient at the time. And he said he couldn't, he was injured, he was in the stand watching. He said he couldn't believe what he was seeing. A goalkeeper let in 8 goals and he gets clapped off the pitch by the fans. And that's how much he was loved. And he was the first player ever to have a car in the league, first league player to ever drive a car. So just the stories of people that we found, names and the history was unbelievable. All in the amateur leagues, the goal scorers. And it was amazing. Amazing research, 4 or 5 years. It was wonderful for us to find all this information and put it into books, you know, if we could do that. And for people to buy them.
Neil, in those interwar years, still at Clapton, of course, there were some very big crowds as well, weren't there, and at the second division club. I mean, people, youngsters, probably think our record attendance was the West Ham Cup tie, the 34,000, but actually there was at least one or two bigger crowds than that at the old Mill Fields, weren't there?
No, Mill Fields, we used to get 38,000, not every game, but when I think it was Millwall came and Tottenham, a game for Tottenham, well past the 34,000 that we had at. Because Millfields was a ground that could hold anything from 40 to 50,000. We never ever got it, but it was capable of holding that. And I'm sure if they would have, you know, Orient in the 1910, 1915 period before the war, we finished fourth twice in the league, in the Division Two. So we were close to getting into the top league at that time. Richard McFadden was scoring lots of goals, George Scott, Parker. We had a brilliant team. They were called Holmes Homerton Heroes because they really did well. Probably one of the London's top second division team at the time. So, yeah, they got decent crowds.
And why did they leave Clapton? My granddad always used to curse a man called the Brigadier, who he thought was responsible for letting them down. And why did we end up at Leighton?
Well, we never ended up at Leighton. We went to Leighbridge Road first. But what happened was that the Greyhound Syndicate wanted greyhound racing in London. And they chose Mill Fields because it was a big grounds. And they started, eventually they did a deal that they would share the ground with the Orient. But eventually what happened was that it did become very popular, greyhound racing, and eventually they kicked the Orient out. They put up the rent so high that it was impossible for them to even stay there, which was a pity because it would have been an excellent ground now to redevelop and what have you. Obviously it's a load of flats now. But so what they did, and they moved to Leighbridge Road, which wasn't a very nice ground at the time, in the early 30s, and played there. You know, there was more third division football, third division south. And then they moved to Leighton Brisbane Road in 1937, when unfortunately the Leighton amateurs had to move because all we wanted to go is. Yes, so that's, but even earlier than that, a few years before that, Orient nearly went out of business and Arsenal put in an offer to take them over. And the deal was actually signed. That they will become, or it will become a nursery club for Arsenal. But eventually the Football League said, no ways. They're not having a league club becoming a nursery for another club. So all it kept on going. And, you know, over the years we've had our financial issues and problems. But, so it was Leighbridge Road and then onto Brisbane Road. Or Osborne Road. As well.
The famous couple of league games at Wembley, of course. What was all that about, 1930s?
Yeah, well, we played... what happened there was we played Torquay United in a league match As I say, 1930s. And they complained, they lost 4-0, or we beat them 4-0. They complained that they said that the fence, the white fence around the pitch, was too close to the pitch, and therefore their players felt restricted. So the league ordered Oria to redo the ground, take the fencing away and expand it, and they allowed to play at Wembley. They beat Brentford 3-1. There was about 8,000, but the second match they played there, I think it was Southend, it was one way or the other, Southend, it was actually the weather was so bad, that they don't even know how they played the match. It was only like 1,100 or 1,200 people there for the second match because of the weather. So we're unbeaten at Wembley in the league games anyway. So that's the reason why, it was because of Torquay United complaint.
A proud record anyway. And what about during the war? Of course, wartime football did carry on a sort of regional basis.
The Second World War. Yeah, I did a whole thing on the website, the club website, on Orient in the Second World War, where I think it's still there. Anybody really wants to be interested. What I did was profile every player from the First World War, and then another separate thing for the Second World War. Profiled every player and the results and all that sort of stuff. It was a very difficult period for the Orient. The manager had to play in goal so many times and what have you, and they used to borrow players in the 30s. We had to, in the 40s, from 39 to 46, we borrowed a lot of players, came on as a guest player, they used to call them. What I did for the history and with the club is that I did the research on that and put that onto the website. So it is on the website, every player there, and it was difficult. We started, I think, if I stand to be corrected, there was one period where we played like 100 games, and I think if we won 5, we did well. And certain matches we lost like 16-2 and things like that. We lost 16-2, I think, at Portsmouth, where a certain number of players couldn't get time off, missed the train to go to Portsmouth. We had about 8 or 9 players on the pitch. And then we used to borrow in the home games. If players never pitched up, they couldn't make it to the ground because either they were serving or couldn't get transport. We used to get fans to play. So it was that type of football, you know.
And then coming a bit more up to date, since the Second World War, I suppose Alex Stock took over. Would you say that was a crucial point when he came from Yeovil and eventually got us out of the Third Division South into the Second Division? How important was Alex Stock at that time?
Well, Alec was very young. He was in his early 30s when he left Yeovil. And it was Harry Zussman who actually approached Yeovil because he liked what they were doing. They had a very good run in the FA Cup. He beat clubs like Sunderland as a non-league team. It was amazing. And he approached them and said, look, I want to bring Alec Stock to Orient. Had a chat to Alec. And Alec, there's photos of him signing his contract at Harry Zussman's office in Shoreditch. And yeah, look, it was amazing. He certainly turned that club around. He got some of his old players into the team from Yeovil who joined the club and started bringing in players. Particularly, I think a big turning point was a player like Billy Rees, who was a Welsh international, was with Tottenham. And Harry Zussman put money up himself to get Billy Rees to the club. 14.5, and big money in those days in the early 50s, £14,500. Outbid clubs like West Ham and Fulham for him. And he certainly turned that club around. And as you say, 56 promotion. It was first time ever for the club. And it was all through Alex. And he got Les Gore, who was with him at Yeovil. And everybody knows the role he played with the club, Les Gore, those years. It was amazing. And he got... it was a big turnaround and very important. That was the turning point for the club because they used to get crowds there of anything up to 20,000. I'm just sorry that I was a bit too young to go there because that was a season. I only went a season after. But that was another reason why my dad took me, because obviously they were in the news and scored 100 goals only for the first time, hundreds odd goals in the league. So it was amazing. And another big turning point was the signing of Tommy Johnston in that season, the second part of that season. He came in and started scoring goals even at that time. And then when I interviewed Tommy for his book, he said how Alec and Les Gore were even more important to him at the Orient for joining. So it wasn't actually Alec, it was Les Gore who met Tommy at the Newport railway station, got him to sign. And that was a big turning point. And of course, as I mentioned, players like Phil Wisdom, Phil White, who was wonderful on the wing. And these were all players developed by Stock and Gore.
Yes, great period. And what about the one season in the First Division? It was a shock that Orient got up with Liverpool, who've done a little bit better since then. But what about, could we have done more financially to stay in the First Division? Could we have strengthened the team more?
You know, what they did is they brought in Johnny Carey the year before as manager when they went up. Johnny, I interviewed Johnny before he passed on for one of my books. He was a very quiet man, Johnny Carey. And he was actually, players have told me, it was Eddie Lewis, who obviously a big good book as well in South Africa when I met him, where we used to meet every week. Eddie told me that it wasn't so much Johnny Carey, it was Les Gore. Johnny was the quiet man behind the scenes. Hardly ever spoke to him. In fact, Eddie said he hardly ever spoke to him. It was Les Gore who did all the talking in the dressing room and the whole thing. And this was confirmed to me by Johnny Carey, you know. So big turning point. And Johnny, as manager, said to Harry Zussman and the board that he felt the players could cope in the First Division. So what Harry did was, he said, instead of spending on players, they decided to upgrade the stand, because the main stand was extended, which cost quite a bit of money. And they didn't buy any, I don't think they bought one player. Only later, players like Bobby Mason came in and things like that. So they used Harry Gregory and they used Dave Dunmore, who did excellently well, and Bill Robertson was in goal, Frank Jules. So they kept the same. They felt that with the defence, Bishop Lee and Lucas, they could cope. But they were top class, probably the best three defenders we've ever had as a combined unit. Stan Charlton, Eddie Lewis at fullback. Eddie was surprised. He always told me that he was surprised they didn't buy that. He felt they needed a couple of extra strikers because they started off quite well in the First Division. You know, they beat Everton 3-0, they beat West Ham 2-0. Man United, as Terry McDonald will tell you, his great goal that we always talk about. So they started off really well. Three wins there and the win over West Ham, they were really excited about. But then things, they didn't spend. And when Harry Zussman and Leslie Grade went to the manager, Carey, and said, look, we'll give you money if you want to, second part of the season, we'll give you money, buy some players. His comment was to them, keep your money. We're not going to survive, keep your money. And that was Johnny Carey. He was out the club after that first season in the First Division. So that's I fully agree with you. If they would have spent money, we probably would have stayed up. And how long we would have stayed there, I'm not sure. But from there, it was a real decline. You know, eventually we were relegated in 65.
Of course. Well, we had our one season in the sun, didn't we? And some of us were lucky enough to see it. Neil, we must wrap up shortly, but you must tell us about your new and final book that will be coming out to commemorate the 140th anniversary. What's going to be in it?
Yeah, so this will be my 13th book on the club. And what I've decided to do is put together something slightly different, but also the same. So the format will be milestones of the club history, brief profiles of every first team player, the managers, the assistant managers, the chairman, directors. I've got a section on, someone said to me, you know, there's all these young players. Why don't we look at some of the youth? So what I'm going to try to do is highlight some of the young players with the Orient, who never got a chance at the club, who went on to big things elsewhere. And a couple that spring to mind to me was Warren Barton, who played for England eventually, was an Orient youth player. The reason he never signed is because Kevin Nugent was signed instead of him because Orient wanted a forward. And then someone that you may not remember or know of, a player called Mickey Cook. He was with Orient in the late 60s as a youth player, played a few reserve games, and a good prospect. He was released, went to Colchester, and has played. He's a record now. He was still a record appearance record holder, over 600 appearances. So, yeah, so that's that section. Someone said to me, with the role of women's football now, is there anything we can do in the book on that? So what I did with some of the people involved in Orient's women, I've put together, and also with the help of Brian Blower in Spain, because he was involved early on in that, is I've profiled briefly every player, women's player, who's represented Orient. So, yeah, so it's the first team players on the bench who never got a chance to appear in the first team, but only on the bench, appearances, record holders, international players, the managers, the chairman. It's going to be, hopefully, we're looking at a two-volume limited edition book in a box type of set for the 140th anniversary. So, yeah, that's it. So that's where we're going to go, hopefully, into the new season.
Brilliant. Well, we will look out for that, of course. We must just, before the end of the programme, turn to this vexed question of the salary cap, which people may have heard the Players' Union, the PFA, have objected to. So for the moment, that's gone by the board. We did ask the club for their reaction, but they're keeping their powder dry, although I think we can assume they're pretty upset because, Lee, they've been really keen on it, haven't they? The EFL are going to have a series more meetings. But, Lee, what do you think of the implications for the players and for the board?
For the players, it's good. I think clubs in general, I think it could be the end for a few clubs. Could be folding on the back of this. Again, I don't know. I mean, like, so we can offer our players more, but so can other clubs now. So there's no guarantee we're going to keep them just because we can offer them more. We had a chance. The chance was there to restructure the league and move it forward, like with 92 teams. And I think it's been missed. I think the money's won again.
Trevor, do you think there'll be any compromise, or is that the end of any salary cap?
Well, you would hope that they get back round the table. But let's say 60-70% turnover goes into the wages, but the EFL would have to make very robust rules. And as we all know, we wouldn't hold our breath on that. But was the cap too low in the first place? Could be one question, especially if you're a Portsmouth or an Ipswich or a Sunderland and they're the same cap as the smaller clubs. There probably should be more dialogue, and hopefully going forward, it can be restructured properly, because we all love the promotion, relegation battles, this, that and the other, and they should remain. If it was a complete level playing field, then it does come down to the technicalities of football. But football in the UK has been broken for quite a while now, hasn't it? So I do feel sorry for the guys who put the time and effort in to try and get it running straight. And obviously they're close to their heart with our chairman's been heavily involved. So let's hope something does come positive out of it. But the PFA and their fella Gordon Taylor, isn't it? He's paid a handsome salary, and that's what he's paid to do. And he's got the deal for the players, and that's who he represents.
Okay, well, we're in added time, but we do, before the end, want to offer condolences from the programme to the family of Simon Feldman, Loz, who to many was the man on the door of the Supporters Club every home game, but also so much more, 30 years on the Supporters Club committee, and later as president. It was good to hear that minute's applause before Saturday's game. And the Orient Hour is putting together a special tribute, which will be available very shortly as a podcast. So do keep an ear and an eye out for that. Big thanks today to Trevor and to Lee, and of course to Neil Kaufman. Glad we avoided the power cuts. Hope we didn't get too much interference on the line from Johannesburg. Very good luck with the book, Neil. And thanks to Billy Herring for producing, to Karen for the podcast, and of course to you for listening. Keep the faith. Let's hope it's not too much longer till we're back at you know where.